From Social Service SG, I'm Jing Yao. Beneath the Rock is a Singaporean book compilation of 30 stories written by 30 different individuals in the social service sector. They're honest sharing on the poor slash marginalized slash disadvantaged in Singapore was surprising. And in this episode with editor Lewin Low, we discuss the project's journey, the writers, and the plans of his social enterprise, Soft M Plus One. Disclosure, I received a free digital copy of the book from the editors. So Lewin, welcome to the podcast. So I'm really excited to talk to you because you and your team go into some detail about how the book Beneath the Rug was conceptualized, as well as the metaphor of the rugs. So maybe to start and kick us off, tell us more about how and when Beneath the Rug was first mentioned among the Soft M Plus One team members.
Hi, Singel. Thank you for having me on this podcast. Really, just to share with you how Beneath the Rug started, it was a side conversation that happened by chance between my founder, Kenneth, as well as his friend. And what happened in the conversation was they were discussing some of the issues that were being faced by the social impact sector. And one of the topics that arose was how little people actually knew about it. And the next thing I knew, I was actually roped into a conversation with them. Quite funny, right? And when we're brainstorming and discussing a couple of things, it got us thinking, how do we actually make the social impact sector accessible to many of us? You have your podcast, their social work made accessible. And for us, I think one of the things that we thought of was to document stories of people in the sector, to shed light about the complexities as well as challenges that they face, and to also celebrate some of the resilience that they actually have when helping people and even from beneficiaries itself. And at the early stage, I think we came up with the discussion with two things. The first, we knew that the only way for people to care more intentionally about the social impact sector is when they know what to care about. And it sounds relatively easy, but it's not. Take, for example, the issue of homelessness. I think many times we would say, okay, if there's a homeless person, let's just build a house, give them a shelter. But that doesn't really tackle the root cause of the issue. And what we do need to know is that beyond just not having a place to stay, I think there are issues like mental well-being. There are also issues and things like a lack of familiar ties that drive them out of the house to the streets and to a place without a shelter. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing that we realized was Soft was in a very special place to at least try to do something about it. Successful or not, we don't know, right? But at least we're in the space to innovate and we're in the space to experiment and try out. And that was really the process of how we had developed Beneath the Rug.
Yeah, and I mean what I'm hearing is presenting the stories as they're presented by your writers in the social impact sector, encouraging the readers to think about the issues, on the underlying kind of structural systemic issues, and also seeing how to position Soft M Plus One in that conversation, which is interesting because you mentioned your founder, Kenneth, and he wrote this in the preface, and I kind of like the quote. So it's quite long, but I'm just going to read it verbatim. So he wrote, the lived experiences of social workers and the clients we serve appear to spring from a side of Singapore that's seldom seen, talked about, or understood, whether intentional or not, many experiences of lack, struggle, deprivation, and conflict have gone untold and swept under the proverbial rug. So that set, you know, you guys thinking, what would we actually see if we've lifted the rug and peered under it? So he then went on to explain this book as our attempt to do just that. So to that end, right, using and bearing in mind the title of the book, you collected 30 stories from a range of individuals who work in the social service, social impact sector. So how did you start the process of gathering the first few stories? And over time, how did you fill it up to 30? And I believe from our earlier conversation, you had a little bit more than 30, but what was the process like in terms of getting the 30 and more than 30 and curating it?
Yeah. Maybe if I could provide some context, right? Singel, just like you, I started business, and we as business people, we're taught in business school that for any product or service that we do as a business, we need to value add. And if we don't value add, then we are simply wasting resources, right? So the process of Beneath the Rug was very much experimental and done in a very agile manner. And we developed a proof of concept to test out its value add with our target users. Mm-hmm. So we started off collecting 3 to 5 stories just from our personal network. And what we did with these stories was to go out, reach out to social service practitioners, both management, social workers, beneficiaries, and people in the social impact sector, just to get their views. And in doing so, I think we wanted to look at two things. I think the first was our hypothesis. So the hypothesis that we had for this project was very simple, that Singaporeans and people in Singapore do care, but sometimes they do lack the safe space to know what to care for and how to care. And the second is this, our belief that undergirds the project, and that is the need for authentic and real sharing about the tensions and dilemmas that people face in the social impact sector. So when we took these 3 to 5 stories to this group of people, we asked them to poke as many holes as possible in this whole project brief and to share their feedback with us. And when we took it back, we sense-made the information, the data. We realized that there was actually a good level of ground support for this project. And from then on, we decided, okay, let's go ahead to collect more stories. And the process of collecting them was rather simple. We put out a call on our social media. We cold emailed various organizations that we thought would have value add to the book. And we also touched base with people whom we know to share with them our projects. And from there, they reached out to their networks and people they thought had interesting stories to share. And I think in total, we collected, you're right to say we collected more than 30 stories. We had 38 in total, 30 are in the book and 8 on our social media platforms. And another interesting thing about what we did, which is rather unusual and you rarely hear about this, was conducting an A-B test. So as more stories came in, I think one of the things that we wanted to understand was how users would interact with the book. So A-B test was simple. We did a mini book, 5 stories, and arranged them in 2 different ways. The first is by theme. So a theme could be youth, another could be the elderly. And the other book that we did, the B test that we did, was to arrange the book according to a person's familiarity with the social impact sector. For example, if you're new to the sector, you should read a couple of stories. If you are a seasoned veteran in the sector, then you can read the other stories. And I think our test really found that the way you arrange the book by theme thematically, it's an easier read for them. And one interesting thing that stood out in collecting this whole feedback and running this whole A-B testing was our audience in general found some of the stories rather heavy, and they suggested the inclusion of more inspirational stories. So all this feedback that we gathered, both from the initial validation as well as A-B testing, lead us to what we have right now, which is Beneath the Rough and the book that you have in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And I will also say, you know, when you were talking about piloting it as well, I think it, and we had this chat beforehand as well, it fits quite nicely into a growing space of books along this kind of themes, right? So you had, you know, this is what inequality looks like, which was ethnography. There's Hard at Work, which documents student interviews with different persons of different occupations in Singapore. You had They Told Us to Move, which is ethnography plus research on Kaseer resettlement project, moving here from another place to another estate in that sense. And so it fits quite nicely into this growing kind of group of texts about social impact, social service, social work sector also. And so you've given us the lay of the land. I was wondering, do you remember what was the very first story you received? Like the very first one of the 3 to 5 you mentioned, what was the very first one and that's included in the book right now?
Yeah, so I think the first story that we received was the first story you see in the chapter. And that is the title is actually called In Singapore, You Love True Food. And it's by a policymaker. And it's a topic that I feel resonates with most of us because when you talk about food, immediately Singaporeans can relate to it. Mm-hmm. And there were 3 things that stood out in this story. So the first was the story writer highlighting the resilience of communities and how communities do possess individuals and the resources and assets to come in and step in to fill the gaps of the problems that arise. So he shares about Madam No, who observed that there were children in her community that were not having proper dinners because their parents were out to work or their parents were not around. And what she did was to cook for these community kids, to give them a place to interact, give them a place to actually come together just for one nice meal. And the second thing that stood out in this story was the fact that he shared that unintended consequences of programs sometimes is something that we don't necessarily think of and we don't consider. And even our best intentions, we do not always acknowledge that it does not translate to best outcomes or outputs. So then we need to really think when we do intervention programs or even programs with partners or beneficiaries about the need to include the element of uncertainty and to give ourselves the room and flexibility to adjust the programs accordingly. So an example he raised was how in our overzealousness and giving in terms of food distribution, we can sometimes cause hygiene issues or even hoarding issues, especially when the recipient may not necessarily eat the food or may not necessarily cook. And it brings me back to, I think, an experience I had 8 years ago when I was doing food distribution with charity. And along one of the houses that I went by, it was a house that was hoarding. And yet the charity still gave the food. And I raised the point of why are we still doing this with the person that I was accompanying. And I think he had no good answer to it. So these are things that we do need to think about and consider in the way that we volunteer, in the way that we contribute. And I think the last thing about this story was on relationships, why we need to build relationships. So he shared that, he shared, back to the story of a guy that hoards, he shared how a community befriender succeeded where all others have failed. And the reason was simple. This community befriender did something very different. So instead of just going there to tell the uncle, hey, we need to clear up your house, there's a fire safety, this group of volunteers actually took the time to buy the uncle durian. And really just sitting down to spend time to have a meal signals to the other party the desire to build trust and to build relationship. And from then on, you have the opportunity to interact and to share more. And people are more willing to accept what you have to say after you build that first baseline of relationship.
Yeah, and I mean, the point about relationships is so important. And I should mention that the story, and to encourage folks to actually get the book, the very first story is titled In Singapore We Love Through Food. It's written by Jerome, who is a pseudonym. It's a policymaker with experience in service delivery and coordination at an SSO or social service office. And the relationships point is interesting because to your experience, it's also about developing empathy and trying to understand where some of these individuals are coming from. So, you know, we are hazarding a guess here, but hoarding could be the result of having very little in the past. And you hoard as a mechanism to make sure that you don't ever run out of food. It could also be, you know, so many well-intentioned folks, as he wrote in the story, who come in with all these dry donations and not really understanding what the individual wants or needs. And so that also forces individuals, the readers, I guess, to kind of think about some of these issues just through the story also. So that was the very first story you received. I guess a related question will be, what's your personal favorite story from the 30 besides that very first story?
Yeah, I think back to your point earlier when you talked about relationship, I just want to elaborate on that. Yeah. It's so true. You really do need to understand the needs of the ground before you actually come in with any interventions. Rather than adopting a I know it all and I know it best type of approach, you really need to go down, understand the needs of the ground before you think and you partner whoever that you're working with on solutions. And to answer your question on which is my favorite story, I think maybe a story that's close to my heart, not say a favorite story, but a story that is close to my heart is titled Don't Report Me, I Won't Do It Again. And the author here is a former residential care worker who is right now in a different social service agency. But it sheds light on the tensions that her client faces, but also the realities of work. On an everyday basis, this writer reckons with the difficulty of straddling her dual identities, one of being a care worker, the other as being a private individual and being herself, as well as the potential of emotional burnout and the weighty responsibilities that she does have to bear. So what is an example of a harsh reality? One thing that she grapples with is the need to constantly convey to her clients the rationale behind why they are in a residential care home and why they do have certain freedoms curtailed, things like having to use the phone only during selected periods of time, having to ask for permission when they go out. And she has to be very mindful because conveying the rationale behind why they are there has the potential to also trigger and bring back some of the client's traumatic experiences and the reason for being in the residential home. And many a time, some of this traumatic experience could be related to sexual abuse. And another thing that she talks about, and this is very real within the social service and the social impact sector, is the realities of crisis work, where crisis can really happen at any time of the day. 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. And it is a huge emotional burden for many to bear. For her, she says, if a client calls you at 3 to 4 a.m. in the morning, warning of a personal crisis, the question for many of us is, what would we do? If we ignore such a call like this and something happens, can we bear to live with it, knowing that if we had answered the call, things could have turned out quite differently? And to this note, I just want to say that, you know, sometimes even caregivers or social service practitioners do need counseling and a space for them to share and unload some of this emotional load that they do have. And I think the writer concludes with two things. The first is that many of us have undergone some form of traumatic experience in our lives, and some of us process it better than the others. And for those that may not necessarily be able to do so, I think we ought to create safe spaces for them. And the next thing she concludes with is on what it means to be successful. So she redefines success. I think in Singapore, we grew up with the narrative that the hallmarks of success is to have a good education and then to subsequently have a good job. And for her, she defines success as having the resilience and determination to live another day in spite of the challenges and trauma that we may be facing.
And that's an important point, because the story, I mean, as a reminder, the story is the ninth story in the collection. That's Don't Report Me, I Won't Do It Again. As you mentioned, talks about trauma, but in your kind of like reflection, it also brings to mind, you know, the saying that says, who will guard the guards? And in the caregiver setting, it's kind of like, who will provide caregiving to the caregivers, right? And, you know, even before COVID, we knew there was a problem. You can imagine right now with the current care crisis as well, that's going to be something that comes up. And the story is written by Rebecca, which is another pseudonym, which allows me to get to my next question, right? Which is, you know, of the 30 stories, most writers overwhelmingly chose to use pseudonyms. And actually, when I reflected this on Twitter, there was someone who mentioned that, yeah, there seems to be a lot of folks who choose not to share who they are. So I guess it's kind of like a two-part question. I think they're related. The first question is whether you had trouble convincing folks to share their identities, right? And whether there was a priority to get people to share. And I guess, you know, the second would be, you know, what were some of the reasons you heard for folks saying, you know, I prefer to remain anonymous, I prefer not to share my identity. So tell us a bit more what your experience was like.
So let me just unpack this question a bit further. And I think there are two key points to draw out. The first is really on credibility, or how credible are these stories to readers? Because when you have a pseudonym, sometimes it does impact the credibility of the stories. And then to add on to this is whether or not it impacts and is detrimental to the reader's experience. And I think the second point is the issue of psychological safety. And this is on soft. So the onus was on soft to actually create this safe space for contributors to share, even if their views were contrary to the majority or dominant narrative. So we wanted the stories to be as authentic as possible, but yet we also wanted the contributors to be as real and as truthful to themselves as they could be. So our story collection process didn't just start off by telling the contributors to share about specific issues. It would have been easier. We started it by asking them to share honestly about what readers ought to know about the sector. So in doing so, what we did was we gave the contributors the option to write anonymously or to write with their real identities. And we shared with them upfront the pros and cons. When you write with your name versus a pseudonym, there are certain pros and cons. And with that, we also assured them whatever decision they chose to make, we would stand by them. And we did so really in full knowledge that we were privileged to be able to tell their story, to hear them out, and also with the understanding that they trusted us to communicate their story in a manner that is accurate, but also authentic, not just to the public, but also to themselves. And on the point of credibility, I think what we did as well was to fact check with various organizations that were mentioned, and also where policies were concerned, we did check in with the relevant government ministries.
Yeah, and I think I should also add, I would say from my opinion, the team was quite careful having prefaces for each of the stories which you felt needed clarifications. You know, I actually quite like the fact that you gave the writers a choice expressly to choose whether you want to share your identity or not, right? Because, I mean, this is my opinion, and I think you should feel free to respond, because I don't think it's on Solve to kind of make a case for it. But I do think one of the motivations for writers to prefer not to share about their own kind of identities, part of it is the privacy and making sure that your cases are confidential. That's one. I think the other one is also being mindful of what the out-of-bound markers might be, right? And so that's an individual decision that folks will have to make. And I personally think, and this is, I don't want to ascribe this to your team or the book, I personally think it's telling of the Singapore kind of structure where the vast majority chose not to divulge themselves. But, you know, and I want to make sure you get a word in here, Fazal. I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. You say that there are certain concerns when you put your name out there. One is on privacy concerns. I think some of them may not necessarily have gotten permission from their organizations. So that is a concern that they do face. And yeah, even some of the stories itself, as you would have noticed, some are more nuanced. And yes, they do talk about certain things in a way that is more palatable. And I think the idea is really not to put people on the defensive. And we realize that once you put someone on the defensive, it doesn't help with the discourse. It doesn't help to bring the conversation forward. And I think this is also a good time for me to caveat that, you know, Beneath the Rub is really just one attempt of many to provide readers with a sense of what's happening. And the book really just is tackling a small part of the giant tapestry that envelops the entire social impact sector. And what I want to encourage the listeners out there is to see this book as a stepping stone, a resource for you to dive in, to get to know the sector. But beyond that, you also would have to continually actively seek out voices, listen, and then also proactively share what your experience is like with others, because that's how we grow the conversation, that's how we grow the discourse, and that's how we come up with solutions that better meet the needs of those in the sector.
Yeah, and so the thing is, this is interesting, because when you mentioned that, you know, the next question I had in mind might go beyond the scope of the book, right? So, you know, you don't have to answer if you don't wish to. You've given us kind of a taste, a little taste of the two stories, one about food insecurity, the other one about trauma. The book itself is organized into five thematic sections, right? So the first is family and community, second, youth and education, then diversity, inclusion, health and care, and then finally, it's about management and policy. And at the end of the book, you write Lifting the Rug, and I think it's an interesting choice of verb. You say peeking beneath it. You would likely have discovered that social issues are complex and never fall quite neatly within an individual, a single organization, or ministry's purview, which is kind of like a nice segue to your previous answer, right? So, you know, be that as it may, and again, you don't have to answer if you don't feel comfortable. From what you have learned from your 30 stories and 30 writers, what is just one kind of structural or policy level change which you think could be considered or maybe pitched to the relevant agencies in that sense?
Happy to answer the question. Maybe if I could give two, one big overarching one.
Yeah, go ahead.
The big overarching change that I hope that we will see is really the way and the lens that we adopt when we view the social impact sector. And this means two things. The first is we do need a set of diverse talents within the social impact sector, and more people need to recognize this. Today in the social impact sector, as a result of training, caseloads, and in search for greater efficiency, we rarely venture off the beaten track. And I think we do need to have a greater appetite for innovation in the daily work that we do to serve the communities in need. And this sentiment was actually echoed by a story writer, and he sits on the management of a large-scale nonprofit that means revenue of above 5 million. And he said, I quote, "If you use the same method, you're not going to have a different outcome." So in a similar vein, we need to relook at the way that we're attracting people to the sector and to really create more opportunities for people of diverse backgrounds to enter and to compensate them fairly. And what I'm going to say is going to sound slightly controversial, don't mind me, but innovation is really encouraged when there's an incentive for people to do so. And many a times, the incentive is monetary in nature. And despite good hearts, many in the sector still need to support themselves, their family, and also achieve certain aspirational goals. And we cannot deny that. And we need to start to build up the safety net for people in the social service sector to innovate without the fear of failing, such that innovation is really not seen as a stumbling block or a pipe dream. So this really reflects the way that Solve is set up. So many people have asked us, is Solve a non-profit? Are we a charity? What are we? We are a private limited, for-profit, private limited, established and recognized as a social enterprise. But the rationale behind this is very simple, right? In order to innovate and build up capacity for the sector. We do need to find and provide a value proposition that people, first of all, recognize, and next, are willing to pay as a measure of their support. And more importantly, this structure keeps us on our toes because it forces us to be agile. It forces us to continuously reinvent ourselves to stay relevant. And this goes back to the first question that you asked and which I responded to, which is Solf is in a place to take that risk. And we want to be in a position that can do that. And private organizations like us have the ability and capacity to do so. So the second thing that I hope we do see a need for is to start to cultivate a healthy increase in our risk tolerance within the social impact sector. We do have a lot of tried and tested programs, and we continue to run these intervention programs, but we also do need to have them run alongside programs with huge amounts of uncertainties that have the potential to leapfrog existing programs. And one way that we can possibly do so is really to re-examine the way we share risk among the different stakeholders, government, corporates, social service agencies, and even individuals. So if I could leave a food for thought for us, would be if corporates and individuals can accept high risk, high rewards in a business, would we not be able to also accept such high risk, high rewards and be bold to fund innovation for the social service agencies as part of their ESG, environmental, social, and governance investment portfolio? I think if we were to have this corporates as well as individuals come in to innovate and provide that amount of funding and risk sharing, we would see tremendous change in the way we operate.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this was former NMP, Lawrence Lee, and he was also former head of MVPC as well, which is very consistent with what you're sharing. You used the metaphor of describing, now they're called social service agencies, but basically nonprofits as, he said, the sites of experimentation. So basically these are sites where programs, services, different interventions can be piloted and determined before they're scaled up. And I think the other thing that will come along with risk taking is also understanding that requires funding also. So it's not just about funding for individual social workers or social service professionals, but also the organizations, the manpower. So I think that's something that's been echoed across many of the guests who have been on the podcast as well. So we've spoken at great lengths about the book, and you alluded to Solf and as a social enterprise, right? So maybe help us understand what your immediate plans, because it's mentioned at the end of the book that part of the aims or goals, and you mentioned this in the beginning, was to create more change makers and volunteers, improve corporate management, and have more social enterprises. So how do you plan to align Solf or the social enterprises' immediate plans with these goals you have laid out in the book, at the end of the book?
So I think the project that we are currently embarking on is Open Home Network 2.0. So for context and for background, Open Home Network was started 2 years back to address the issue of homelessness. And one of the things we realized was there were assets in the communities, and how can we build relationships with persons in crisis or rough sleepers and match them with people who have spare rooms for a period of 3 to 6 months such that they have the bandwidth to then work through the crisis with social workers. So 2.0 is the sense that one of the things we hope to do is to partner with various organizations. So people who are in managing transit houses with HDB, and through this build volunteer management strategies, getting in folks from FSCs, from corporates to come in to be back to our point of relationship building. That is very important. And through this, we hope to encourage them to come in skill-based volunteerism to lend their skills for innovation. So that is how we are looking ahead for the year.
And last but not least, I'd be remiss not to have you share how to get a copy of the book. A link to the Beneath the Rug book to purchase the book is in the show notes. But tell us more about how folks, if they're interested in the work that you're doing with the Homeless Network, with the Rough Sleepers Network, how they might be able to get in touch with you and your team.
You can drop me an email at lewin@solven+1. So it's lewin@solvenplus.one. And I think you can reach out if you're interested to connect, to learn about the work that we do, or even to explore potential for collaboration, whether or not you're a corporate, an individual, or even a social impact organization. We'll be happy to explore with you what we can do to enhance and enrich and build the sector.
Yeah, and I No, thank you for your time. Just now, I mentioned that the choice of the verbs lifting the rock and peeking beneath it is really apt because, as you've mentioned and emphasized, it's really the start of set of initiatives that's to come. And you know, the rock is a big one. So that means there are a lot more stories, a lot more diverse individuals, and a lot more diverse narratives that will come down the road. And it's great that you all have started the ball rolling. So thank you for doing the book. Thank you for launching it. And all the best with all your future endeavors.
Thank you so much, Danielle. Thanks for having us on the podcast.
Thank you.